Well, I'm here in two capacities. First, above all, to introduce Philip, but also to say this event is sponsored by the Centre for the Study of the Renaissance here at Warwick, which is a long-standing research centre, which has hosted many conferences, but co-hosted by the Capital Centre, our new Centre for Creativity and Performance in Teaching and Learning, which is dedicated to bringing together the academic arts and the arts of the theatre. So the Capital Centre, of which I'm the director, is sponsoring the visit of Exterminating Angel later in the day, and the more sort of theatrical, filmic, practical side of things. And it's the first time the Centre for the Study of Renaissance and the Capital Centre have done something together, so we're very pleased about that. But I'm especially pleased to be introducing our keynote speaker this morning, who's Philip Edwards, who was for many years the King Alfred Professor of English Literature at Liverpool, and I had the honour to be his successor in that chair. But there's no one better to start off a conference on Kidd than Philip, because of course it was his Revels play edition of the Spanish tragedy that really laid the foundation for the modern serious study of Kidd nearly half a century ago. But of course, in addition to that, Philip has written about the relationship between Shakespeare and his contemporaries. He's edited the works of Massinger, a writer who I think is very much a descendant of Kidd in all sorts of interesting ways. And he's also written very importantly about the whole idea of drama, historical drama, in relation to the formation of nationhood in England, in Spain, and in Ireland. Philip is the perfect person to have giving our keynote speech, which is called, and I did write this down, but again, Supernatural Structures, that's right, in Kidd and Shakespeare. So, Philip Edwards, welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Jonathan, for those kind words. My title is pretentious and pompous and long-winded, Supernatural Structures in Kidd and Shakespeare. And this paper is going to be largely retrospective, and I do apologise for that. Well, as Jonathan was saying, 1959 is a long time ago, but I remember better the autumn of 1955 when I got back to England after a year at Harvard, where my research into poetry and patronage in the early 17th century seemed to be going precisely nowhere, to find a letter from Clifford Leach, my friend Clifford Leach, who was then at Durham, asking me if I would edit the Spanish tragedy for his new series of plays, which were soon to be called the Revels plays. I felt a little like Hieronymo, when the letter from Bellimperia fell at his feet. A new direction had come into my life. So I accepted and I worked con amore, and my edition came out in 1959. Well, I felt then, after 3 years of hard work, that I didn't want any more to do with Kidd for some time. But in the mid-1960s, I was writing a little booklet on early Elizabethan tragedy in the British Council series, and I took advantage of that to press the case for Kidd, at the same time putting him more in his historical context. Taking plays from Pickering's Orestes to the anonymous Arden of Feversham, I spoke of those comparatively rare plays which freed themselves from the moral cliché of the time, especially as regards divine guidance in human affairs, or divine guidance of human affairs. And Kidd I paired with Marlowe, whom you will remember were two people writing in one chamber, as writers of extraordinary originality, I quote from myself. Kidd, whom I then called, compared with Marlowe, a minor writer, had, by a strange inspiration, produced something quite new. Ignoring Marlowe's concern with the titanic individual, he concentrated in the Spanish tragedy on the web of consequence, which Shakespeare was later to exploit in Romeo and Juliet, the interweaving of the passions, desires, and plans of a number of individuals, the outcome of which had nothing to do with providence or divine guidance. in the Spanish tragedy, I said, our attention is centred on Jeronimo, on his pain as he strives to clear a path for justice in a world too complex for anyone to understand, let alone control. Now, it was some years before I took up seriously the objection that the outcome of the Spanish tragedy is not in the web of consequence I've been talking about, but in the dictates of destiny, as explained by the figure of revenge on the stage or throughout the play. Both in my edition and in the British Council booklet, it is implied that the whole apparatus of all-controlling destiny is a farce. But it is only in my lecture of 1985 at Waterloo in Canada that I tried to explain why. And that lecture concentrated on the supernatural structures of the Spanish tragedy. I emphasized the distance in time between the busy, unavailing efforts of the human characters in 16th century Spain and Portugal and the overarching supernatural control symbolized by the presence of Andrea's ghost and the figure of revenge. Andrea, you will remember, had been killed in the fictional 16th century battle between Spain and Portugal, and his spirit had been transported back through the centuries to a carefully reconstructed Virgilian underworld. Those who judge the dead, Iacus, Minos, and Radamanth, couldn't agree whether Andrea should spend eternity with lovers or with martialists. So, undecided, they send him to Pluto, the king of the underworld, for a decision. Proserpine intervenes and begs Pluto that the decision shall be hers. Pluto agrees, and after a certain amount of whispering, Andrea's ghost is sent back under the tutelage of revenge to witness the doings of the mortals he has left. Specifically, he is to see, quote, the author of thy death, Don Balthazar, the prince of Portingale, deprived of life by Belimperia. Now, Andrea, who was killed by fortune of the wars and had never asked for revenge against his killer Balthazar, shows great enthusiasm for this scheme and is overjoyed at the end of the play to be reunited with Belimperia for eternity. It appears that the whole horrifying course of events, the murder of Horatio, Belimperia's new lover, the search by the father, Jeronimo, for the killer of his son, the extravagant schemes of Lorenzo to conceal the truth, Jeronimo's play and the murder of Lorenzo and Balthazar, the suicide of Belimperia, the grisly death of old Jeronimo, have been engineered to fulfill the whim of Proserpine, that the death of Andrea should be avenged by the death of Balthazar. I emphasized then that the decree of Proserpine was a mere whim. What is Andrea to her? The ghost of Andrea is a little optimistic about his clandestine affair with Belimperia when he says that the infernal powers will not tolerate a lover's woe. Is the union in eternity of Andrea and his mistress worth the terrible route by which it is reached? To balance these pagan infernal powers, which I spoke about, which seem to have ultimate and absolute control, Kidd arranged his group of supernal powers who are Christian. These powers are thanked in routine fashion by the Spanish king when he learns of his military victory over the Portuguese. Then blessed be heaven and guider of these heavens from whose fair influence such justice flows. But Jeronimo, also believing that heaven supports justice and seeking to know who killed his son, says, I find the place impregnable. Like one of the entrants I've just read for the title of Young Cumbrian Writer of the Year, He said, I turned to God, but only got the answer phone. This person did not win, though he or she deserved to. Momentarily, Geronimo appeals to the infernal gods for help, but gets no sign of assistance from Proserpine at Pluto's court. And convinced, you remember, that no gods of any kind are interested in helping him, he resolves to pursue justice by himself and begins to make his plans. It is particularly interesting that it's just at this moment, when he overhears Belimperia castigating him for his inaction, and he feels sure of her as an ally in his efforts, he says, "Why then? I see that heaven applies our drift, and all the saints do sit soliciting for vengeance on those cursed murderers." This late conviction that heaven is on his side, to which I shall have to return, seems sabotaged when Hieronymus's scheme goes awry with Belimperia's suicide and his own gory death, dragging the unoffending Duke of Castile with him. At any rate, in this 1985 lecture, which I'm summarising, I was convinced that Kidd's play was, I quote myself, a denial of God's care for man. And while it attributed the lethal cross-cancellation of human desires and intentions to destiny, there was utter meaninglessness in the edicts of that destiny. I spent a good deal of time on Kidd's preoccupation with Seneca's tragedies, which I argued Kidd must have read in the original. In Seneca, I said, there was a dreadful logic in the chain of crime from generation to generation, but that in Kidd there was no such logic. A careful and determined reading of Seneca might well have concluded that among all the attempts of characters to find reasons for the awfulness which he describes, quote, no explaining voice is privileged, nothing is certain concerning the gods but their remoteness, indifference, absence. Such a reading might be based, I said, on the renowned conclusion of Seneca's Medea, when Jason shouts after the heroine as she is borne away in her winged car, testare nullos esse, qua veheris deus. Bear witness wherever you ride that there are no gods. Now if, as I thought in this lecture in Canada, the Spanish tragedy was a challenge to conventional ideas about the divine control of human affairs, Kidd's relationship with Marlowe may be seen in a different light. Kidd's denunciation of Marlowe may well have been dictated by fear and was almost certainly the result of torture. The atheistical disputations which were found among Kidd's papers, which he insisted were Marlowe's, might well have been his own. Utterly different in temperament though the two writers were, there may have been a real sympathy in their scepticism. And I noted in that Canadian lecture that there was a third dramatist whose tragedy seemed to take a view of human life not remotely compatible with a Christian view of providence, and that was Shakespeare in his Titus Andronicus. My Canadian lecture was given in the same year, 1985, that saw the publication of my new Cambridge edition of Hamlet. And in that edition, following a not particularly original course in a sea of guesses, I accepted the view that Shakespeare, around 1600, based his play of Hamlet on an earlier play which might have been by Kidd. If Kidd wrote the Hamlet, that play probably preceded the Spanish tragedy, and it introduced into the old story of Hamlet a ghost who, we are told by Thomas Lodge in 1596, cried so miserably at the theatre like an oyster wife, "Hamlet, revenge!" I can't really do an oyster white. I must admit I cherish the idea that at the height of his power, Shakespeare was deeply influenced by twin revenge plays written by a dramatist whose view of life he had not despised in his younger days. When Shakespeare rewrote Hamlet, he needed Kyd, both the Hamlet and the Spanish tragedy. He borrowed from Kyd and he put Kyd right. He borrowed the ghost and made that ghost the centre of his play. I've often thought that it was the existence of that ghost in the Hamlet, oyster wife or not, that made Shakespeare think of rewriting the play. After Stephen Greenblatt's book, we can all see that the forceful revival of the idea of purgatory, in whose fires the ghost of old Hamlet had to spend most of his time, revives the link between the living and the dead, which the Reformation, with its denial of purgatory, had seriously harmed and perhaps severed. The use of the ghost doesn't provide much evidence about Shakespeare's own religious views. The ghost is a theatrical image. But that image is compounded of beliefs and ideas inherent in the forbidden doctrine of purgatory, and Shakespeare's play needed the beliefs which the presence of the ghost conjured up. The presence in arms of the former king of Denmark keeps young Hamlet in touch with his father's values and everything his father stood for. The ghost brings the past alive, not only the immediate past with the circumstances of his wife's adultery and his own murder at Claudius's hand, but the longer past of Denmark, wrapped up in the majesty of the king that's dead. All this young Hamlet promises to honour and remember, not only what his ghostly father commissions him to do, but also what his father stood for. It seems important that the idea of purgatory, which brings most sharply into Hamlet's life not only the wishes of the dead, but the world lived in by the dead, was by 1600, you might say, a dead letter. This invocation of the past belongs to the past. The doctrine of purgatory, as the anteroom of eternity where you wait while the crimes of nature are burnt away, was a very late Catholic doctrine. It was abominated by proto-Protestants for centuries. And at the same time that Shakespeare wrote his Hamlet, it had for decades been stamped out in England by the Reformation. Its revival, in the person of the ghost on the battlements of Elsinore, seems a deliberate atavism. In that atavism, there is to my mind a distinct parallel with the Spanish tragedy, with its dispatch of Andrea from his death on the battlefield of a 16th century Iberia to a Virgilian land of the dead and the gloomy underground halls of Pluto. The glacial time gulf between the frame of the story and the story itself, and particularly the casual intervention of Proserpine, seems to me to question the ideas of ultimate destiny at the very time that, with the presence on stage of the figure of revenge and his constant insistence on the force of destiny, Kyd calls attention to the continued presence of these ideas. And it seems to me that Shakespeare's ghost in his Hamlet, borrowed, I have suggested, from Kyd, similarly represents both continuance and obsolescence. An out-of-date doctrine insists that the past is alive. Whatever the influence of Kyd there may be in Shakespeare's ghost, there is no doubt about the parallels between the two dramatists in a major point of the plot in their most famous plays. In the soliloquy towards the end of the Spanish tragedy, when he enters with a book in his hand and starts with "Vindicta mihi," Jeronimo seems convinced that heaven in its own time will bring about the revenge for murder. But just as strongly, he asserts his own responsibility for choosing the time and the means by which he himself will exact revenge. And so he goes ahead with his plans for his climactic play. In Shakespeare's play, although Hamlet has, unlike Jeronimo, not found heaven impregnable, he certainly changes and alters what seems to be heaven's orders. Most prominently, he passes up the opportunity of taking revenge on Claudius in the prayer scene, and going straight to his mother, defies the injunction to leave her to heaven, and he does his utmost to convert her. Later, after his return from his adventures at sea, he seems to renounce such individual responsibility when he says that when our deep plots do pall, we should accept that there's a divinity that shapes our ends, rough-hew them how we will. And at the same time, his later questions to Horatio stress the role of individual decision and individual action once the conviction of divine guidance has been achieved. Does it not, think thee, stand me now upon? Is not perfect conscience to quit him with this arm? He therefore accepts the challenge to the fencing match and so enters the slaughterous confusion which ends the play. Both the Spanish tragedy and Shakespeare's Hamlet have the same theme: the responsibility of the individual and the responsibility of the gods in carving out the future. But in the disastrous ending of both plays, there is the suggestion that the future belongs neither to the individual nor to the gods. And yet, the actual conclusion of each play, the conclusions are so different that we can't help feeling that the later play, Shakespeare's Hamlet, is a comment on the earlier, on the conclusion of the earlier play. I'm referring to the gloating of the ghost of Andrea at the end of the Spanish tragedy, and the absence of the ghost of the old king at the end of Hamlet. I said this talk was retrospective, and I'm referring to a lecture which I gave in 1981, which was published. "I," says Andrea's ghost, "these were spectacles to please my soul." He lists all those who have been killed, including the Duke of Castile and Bellimperia and Jeronimo by their own hands. But in Hamlet, nothing follows the funeral procession. The ghost who is in the first act of the play and reappears in the third is never seen again. It's possible, of course, that the ghost was absent at the conclusion of the Hamlet. But whether Shakespeare is responsible or not for the failure of the ghost to reappear, the absence is strikingly different from the endorsement of the decree of destiny provided by Andrea at the end of the Spanish tragedy. One shouldn't say such things, but Kidd surely made a mistake by bringing Andrea's ghost on at the end to gloat. Andrea's satisfaction at the workings of destiny goes against what the play has said. The failure of the ghost of old Hamlet in Shakespeare's play to express his approval or disapproval of the prince's handling of his command and the way Claudius died, and not only Claudius but Gertrude and Ophelia, leaves the play in the uncertainty which rightly belongs to it, and which rightly belongs, in my opinion, also to its predecessor. Now, the Kid trail proper in Shakespeare culminates in Hamlet. The Kiddian inheritance is only fitfully to be seen so openly in Shakespearean tragedy as it is in Hamlet, but it was nonetheless deep and important. Kidd's inheritance was of a form, a legacy I should say, was of a form of tragedy, less of the tragedy of the overweening individual than of the intersecting paths of the desires and passions of relatively ordinary individuals, a sort of mutual cancellation or mutilation of intentions. Among the characters, there's an in both dramatists, there is an overwhelming desire to believe in providence, leading to ideas, conceptions, suggestions of divine control and guidance, of great ingenuity, especially when it comes to explaining the eventual benefits of adversity. In the face of the apparent lack of transcendental support, the injured individual may be induced to force what he considers to be truth and justice on an unwilling social authority. But alas, his determination ends only in both Hamlet and Spanish tragedy, in failure and disaster. Now, in Shakespearean tragedy as a whole, there is, apart from the ghost in Hamlet, a remarkable absence of supernatural structures. Otherwise, this talk would be endless. The most obvious of such structures is, of course, the witches or weird sisters in Macbeth. But they have nothing to do with Kidd. Indeed, Macbeth is an anti-Kiddian play. Within both Shakespeare's early tragedies and Kidd's tragedy, there is a latent Manichaeism or Bushism. Society seems to be a contest between the well-intentioned and the ill-intentioned, and you're born that way. One is a good person or a bad person. Kidd's Lorenzo, superb villain, is succeeded by such outright villains as Iago and Edmund. As an explanation of why things go wrong in the world, the division into good people and bad people seems crude and facile. Perhaps Shakespeare's discomfort with this classification is shown in his preoccupation with people on the brink between the two, especially in Macbeth. Now, if Macbeth seems manichaeistic, that may be because of political prudence on Shakespeare's part. What is good and what is a fortunate outcome tend to be on the English side. But essentially, the play is about the growth of evil, like some cancer within goodness itself. The idea of evil as perverted good is, of course, very similar to the Christian idea of the fallen angels. And indistinguishability is the war cry of the play of Macbeth. Angels are bright still, though the brightest fell. Though all things foul would wear the brows of grace, yet grace must still look so. The supernatural structure, which I only just want to mention here, of the play is the provision of the weird sisters, the witches who know the future without causing it, and who use their knowledge in order to corrupt and contaminate. I find them utterly baffling. What is the relation of their knowledge to the decisions of Banquo and Macbeth? All we know is that the latter two feel that they share their natural life with a supernatural life, and that they are led in one direction or another by voices from another world, which they may obey or disregard. The ghost of Banquo at the dinner reinforces this sense of living both inside and outside time, but it has no metaphysical implications that I can see. There is indeed a supernatural structure in Macbeth, but it leads nowhere. It's in that slightly earlier play, King Lear, that there is more questioning by the characters about the ultimate control of human affairs, and in that play, which in my own opinion Shakespeare never completed to his own satisfaction, there is no supernatural structure at all. But consider, please, the role of Edgar in that play. Dispossessed by the lies and slanders of his half-brother and hunted to the death by his gullible father, the Earl of Gloucester, who has believed those lies, he strips himself naked and takes on the identity of poor Tom, one of those beggars who pretend to be escaped lunatics. In this guise of double pretense, he convinces the king that he is, in fact, an accommodated man. And remember, Lear says, "Is man no more than this?" Poor Tom invents his past, a serving man who has done the act of darkness with his mistress, one who has lived for sex and finery and wine, false of heart and bloody of hand, and now he is a foul, ragged beggar, haunted and pursued by the foul fiend. In this guise, he leads his blinded father, Gloucester, who wants only to end his life by throwing himself off the cliffs of Dover. And so we come to that extraordinary and unexplained farce of the pretended suicide. Everybody tries to explain it. We understand that Edgar has begun to see his mission as that of a saviour of souls, and he convinces his father that he, his father, has fallen from the cliff and yet is still alive. Edgar, in a new guise, now pretends to be a passerby, finding Gloucester at the foot of the cliff. "Thy life's a miracle," he says. And he goes on to pretend that he has seen Gloucester's former guide at the top of the cliff, a foul fiend who had led Gloucester to end his life. And now he's saved. "Therefore," says this mercurial Edgar to his blind father, "think that the clearest gods have preserved thee." And the quite bewildered Gloucester, blinded Gloucester, forswears despair. "Henceforth I'll bear affliction till it do cry out itself, enough, enough, and die." And I'll just remind you very quickly of Edgar's final change of identity when he appears as a knight in armour to challenge his false half-brother Edmund. He defeats him and speaks these astonishing words concerning his father's begetting of this illegitimate son: "My name is Edgar, and thy father's son. The gods are just, and of our present vices make instruments to plague us. The dark and vicious place where thee he got cost him his eyes." Shakespeare has made Edgar into a supernatural structure. Edgar has become a superb actor, appearing before his king, and then his father, and then his half-brother, and has convinced each of them, in his disguise, of the way the gods control the world. It's all made up. Here is a character who is like Hamlet, an individual determined to put the world right, and who uses his gift as an actor to express the will of the gods as he sees them. All this is scripted by Shakespeare, who does not expect us to believe that Edgar's self-righteous conviction is his own. It is surely not a very long step from the creation of Edgar to the most elaborate of Shakespeare's supernatural structures, which he presented in that extraordinary series of plays at the close of his career, including Pericles, Cymbeline, and The Tempest. Do you remember how in Cymbeline the King of Gods appears on the stage? He descends onto the level of the stage level, sitting upon an eagle. He throws a thunderbolt, and then he speaks to his audience, including the sleeping Posthumus. Be not with mortal accidents oppressed. No care of yours it is. You know 'tis ours. Whom best I love, I cross. To make my gift, the more delayed, delighted. Be content. And in The Tempest, it is a mortal man, Prospero, cast up on his island, who has acquired magical powers, who sets up a supernatural structure in which the spirit Ariel, in the figure of a harpy, addresses the bad people as the voice of Providence itself. And the voice of Providence itself, spirit Ariel, begins, "You are three men of sin, whom destiny that hath to instrument this lower world," and so on. And in his speech, Ariel says, "You fools, I and my fellows are ministers of fate." And afterwards, Prospero, the manager, congratulates Ariel on his performance. "Bravely the figure of this harpy hast thou performed, my Ariel." These last plays of Shakespeare are dream plays, islands of improbable dreams, made real by the potency of poetry and the skill of the actor, which, as they move remorselessly towards their happy conclusions, never reveal more clearly that the voice of God is the voice of the dramatist and the actor, never more clearly than when Prospero, offering some vanity of mine art, mimics divine providence. Now, it's a long road from the Spanish tragedy to The Tempest, from Proserpine to Prospero, but I believe it is a direct road. Kidd's skepticism lies in the preposterous idea of destiny which rules in Pluto's caves. The idea of destiny in the Spanish tragedy is a blind. To conceal what the play itself shows, that the future is brought about chiefly by the crossing intentions and desires and actions of individual human beings. Shakespeare's skepticism was nurtured by Kidd. There was an alarming turn in the road when Shakespeare's disbelief in the power of the theatre to enclose within a tragedy the full truth about human destiny was accompanied by an increase of belief in the power of the theatre to please and console its audience. The latter belief inspired and explains the preposterous providential outcomes of these last plays. The supernatural structures in those last plays may seem to deny and oppose Kidd's skepticism. On the contrary, they support it. The road from Kidd's supernatural structures to those of Shakespeare's has curious bends, but it is in fact direct. Thank you.
Philip, would you take some questions if they come from the floor?
Of course.
Questions?
Or comments?
Or comments? You mentioned that you thought that bringing on the ghost at the end might have been a mistake. And I've often thought that bringing on the epilogue to Dr. Faustus was a mistake. Given the relationship between authority and skepticism, and those two playwrights working in that chamber together, and the arrest and so on, do you feel sometimes that there is a kind of swerve back into orthodoxy as a kind of maneuver at the end of plays? Let me just ask as well, because I often think this with Middleton as well, that Middleton at the end of a play, having done all sorts of outrageous and radical things, sort of gets religion in the final 10 moments, yeah, and then grabs the whole play back for conservatism.
Maneuver is a good word. Carol, I would love to have spoken about Marlowe, but I've spoken about Kidd and Shakespeare. And I think that I see the most interesting play of that group of plays, which I'm afraid I think includes Titus Andronicus. I look at the editor. I do find Dr. Faustus the most puzzling and the most interesting, and the play about which I can give no real final answers because we have no text. I mean, the texts mm-hmm. are so strangely opposed at critical moments. I do find also, even if one tries to think, the best one can to try to think what is Marlowe's play, that there is an extraordinary movement between, you know, really fierce wonder, am I damned? Is there a truth by which I'm damned? And sheer pantomime. Mm-hmm. One does not know what to make of it, and this not knowing what to make of it is made worse by the fact we have the A and the B text, and sometimes the B text is so literal, especially about hell, and the A text is so uncertain about it. So I see really that these manoeuvres of this group of dramatists, Marlowe, Kidd and the young Shakespeare, that in some sense the manoeuvre comes about because of longing to believe, and I do think that longing to believe is there in destiny, in the Spanish tragedy, in the idea of destiny, and in Andrea's gloating at the end. I'm very glad of the word manoeuvre, your word manoeuvre. It does help a great deal. I know that when I finished this lecture in Canada in 1981, which I have rather summarised in my talk, that I was not set upon, that's the wrong phrase, I was stopped by the former professor of English at Warwick University, George Hunter, who said, more or less, look here, he didn't say look here, but he might have done. He said, they all believed, every Calvinist believed in destiny. They believed in predestination. And the more I think about it, the more I think, yes, that's right. And they had the same absurdity in trying to justify predestination, did those Calvinists, as a kid did. It doesn't worry me at all. I think it helps to know that a lot of Calvinists also thought in destiny, because perhaps, as you'll see from what I think from my paper, that the idea that all these people have to die in order to reunite Andrea with the Bella Imperia, and all these horrible things have to happen, is not more absurd, but it is absurd, not more absurd than predestination. That's my thought.
Questions or comments? Be bold, this is your opportunity.
Can I?
Yes. Yeah.
Philip, I especially loved your reading of Edgar and King Lear. I thought that was superb. But it if you'll allow me to suggest this, it sort of convinced me more than ever that there wasn't a Hamlet, but that it wasn't by Kyd.
Uh-huh.
And the reason I say that is because the very striking thing about the way that Shakespeare writes the old Queen's Men King Lear play in King Lear is exactly the way in which he takes out this structure of gods. If you remember in the old Lear play, there's one moment when a good character is about to be stabbed to death, but lo and behold, a thunderbolt sort of comes down and the knife falls from the villain's hand. That very sort of old-fashioned providential pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, Shakespeare removes that, and what happens is that justice of a kind is ultimately executed through the performance of Edgar. And so it suggests to me by a similar analogy, what probably happened in the old Hamlet play was a very strong sense of divine justice being enacted partly through the instrument of this oyster wife ghost.
Mm.
And then what Shakespeare decided to do in Hamlet was take away that structure and have the kind of messy ending that you get with the fight with Laertes and so on. So it seems to me it's actually much more likely that the old Hamlet play was written by someone like the author of the old Lear play rather than a very sophisticated dramatist of the sort that Kyd was, a sceptical dramatist of the sort Kyd was in the way you suggest.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't profess to any knowledge about who wrote the Hamlet, and I've made a little case, you've made a case too. I am the more taken by this idea of Edgar and that monstrous business on the cliff as a supernatural structure by Lear's remark when he comes in and finds Edgar and Gloucester on the beginning of that, is it Act 14:6? That magnificent scene, which, you know, all Lear's remarks are insane, and yet, you know, tremendous truths are told. Now, do you remember what is the first thing that Lear says when he gets into the mad sea, when he appears? I'm sure it's not true that none of you remembers. What's the first remark he makes when he surveys all those others who are on the stage, the blinding Gloucester and Edgar and his father? He says, "Nature's above art in that respect." Now, do you know there's been volumes of commentary on that? Nobody knows why he says that. Well, I do. Because he has just seen an extraordinary work of art in Edgar's ridiculous pretense that, you know, of the cliff and the fall. And he says, looking at that, well, that wasn't a bad go, but gosh, I've suffered more, you know. Nature's above art in that respect. What's happened to me is real. It wasn't really the only stage, but what's happened to me is real. But what you've pretended, Edgar, has happened is art. Well, I offer it to you. Sorry, I'm just going off. I'm just going off the tangent.
Just a tangent from that. I just wondered what you think about the role of the Portugal plot.
Ah.
Spanish tragedy, where we have a kind of precedent for the double narrative.
Well, thank you very much for that, which I avoided because I thought I hadn't time. You're talking about the Villopo plot against Alexandra. Is it Alexandra? Somebody? Alexander. And the witnessing of that by the Viceroy of Portugal, who condemns Alexander to death, and then at the very last moment in comes news that Balthazar is perfectly well in the Spanish court, and therefore Villopo has betrayed with an absolute lie this falsehood and is led off to the torture. So that's what you're referring to. And everybody says, what's that in the play for? Well, George Hunter knows, and the person who revised my edition of the Spanish tragedy, David Bevington, he knows too. And what is being illustrated in those scenes is how divine justice actually works. Now, divine justice, it's sheer chance. His Annie might have gone the other way. And he found out later that his son was alive. And it, to my mind, well, it clinches my idea of kids' skepticism. If you look at those scenes, the viceroy never invokes the deity at all. He just says fortune, and he gives the conventional picture of fortune standing on the ball. The ball is ever rolling, and anything may happen. And I think it's just an illustration of the magic, fortunate outcome of chance, and is almost an attack on the notion of providence. I say almost with proper caution, but it is funny that that sort of statement about, we see the gods are there directing our lives, is simply not in the Villapo 2 extracts.
Can I go see and kind of comment more on the actual Spanish tragedy? You've got a subplot that comments on the main plot, and it's all to do with dissimulating lying and
yes.
Sort of villainy, I think.
Well, that I do accept. The sheer villainy of Villapo is, I think, meant to be a striking, as you obviously take it, a striking major fact in the whole play's scene of the story of the Spanish tragedy, and not an example of divine justice.
I was actually thinking of the scenes with the empty box, the Gringano scenes.
Mm-hmm. A very good example indeed. I'm
yes.
Sorry, I hadn't really brought that into
that's
play.
Right.
You're quite right.
That's right, because he thinks that the thing is in there, and we know as an audience.
We know, we've seen the
lid,
we've seen the boy's
shown,
amazement.
You
know. Why, there's nothing in this box, he says. Yes,
yes.
He knows. Yeah. Thank you very much for that.
It's
I
almost
really
like a reliquary, isn't it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't thought about that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.